Thank you. And now for something completely different. In 1724, Bernard Mandeville published for the third or fourth time his fable of the bees. It's a poem, and I'm going to read an excerpt of it from it. A spacious hive well stocked with bees that lived in luxury and ease. No bees had better government, more fickleness, or less content. They were not slaves to tyranny, nor ruled by wild democracy. Envy itself and vanity were ministers of industry. Their darling folly, fickleness, in diet, furniture, and dress. The strange, ridiculous vice was made, the very wheel that turned the trade. Thus vice nursed ingenuity, which joined with time and industry, and carried life conveniences, its real pleasures, comforts, and ease, to such height that the very poor lived better than the rich before. Perhaps the best example of spontaneous order in human history is the evolution of language. But what brought about the structure in language? While it's true that some studies point to deep grammar structures and others point to a long process of natural selection, it's likely the synthesis of these two ideas that exist in storytelling and early characters passed down along with the evolution of language. This spontaneous order in character models is best summed up in the literary and psychological study of archetypes. Sorry, I'm going to read most of this because I've probably put in a bit too much. The study of popular culture and market forces has been explored in a libertarian context, but across the 19th and 20th centuries, many classical liberal thinkers focused their attention on philosophy, politics, and economics, ceding the study of popular culture, especially archetypes, tropes, and motifs, to philosophies with very different political worldviews. This research intends to revive and reinforce a need for a systematized approach to understanding and describing popular culture narratives and archetypes from a classical liberal and libertarian standpoint. The economist Tyler Cowen pointed out how high and low culture have complemented each other throughout history. Successful high culture usually comes out of a healthy and prosperous popular culture. Art consists of a continual dialogue between producer and consumer, and this dialogue helps both parties decide what they want. Libertarian scholars like Cowen point to the copious research in literature from the 20th and 21st century on the interaction of culture and politics and commerce, and have made contributions to it. Some of the early qualitative studies of Don Lavoie and Emily Chamley Wright can act as a political grounding. And Paul Cantor reminds an outspoken libertarian and free market theorist of pop culture. These theorists will provide vital context to this research. But unlike earlier libertarian cultural theorists, this particular research is designed to locate practices to measure shared archetypes, idioms, and tropes using existing systems such as the Arnott-Thompson classification and motif indexes to measure archetypes and pop culture icons. This move toward an economies of archetypes and a libertarian approach to measuring the creation, dissemination, and inflation of these tropes. As both scholars and the public become more media savvy, there is an increasing need for a way to discuss the components of narrative in pop culture, politics, and classical literature and arts. Our mediated meta-narrative society needs methods of describing archetypes, motifs, and the building blocks of story and character. For background, this research begins with workable definitions of archetypes and motifs, and then of stereotypes and cliches. An archetype can be defined by the Jungian approach of a primitive mental image that is inherited either intrinsically and neurologically, or extrinsically and culturally, from our earliest shared genetic and cultural ancestors. This contrasts with the idea of cliché, which is an image, character, or trope that has been concretized by a particular representation or usage, and, while still a signifier to the original archetype, a cliché has a particular grounding in a time and place. Clichés are considered less valuable not only because of their overuse, but because they can only partially represent the much deeper ideas implicit in the archetype. Another term for cliché, stereotype.
For this research, a motif will be defined as a metaphysically dominant and recognizable idea or form in a narrative work of art. This could apply to architecture, music, fine arts, theater, cinema, and other narratives. For this particular research, a trope is a specific deployment of a motif. Motifs can be arranged into an overarching narrative plot and story, or may be used repeatedly in architecture and artworks. A rough analogy may be made that clichés are to archetypes as tropes are to motifs. The etymology of both cliché and trope include a specific motion or rendering of an abstraction into a specific use. For the most part, this actual classification of tropes, motifs, and narrative structures should be metapolitical, but occasionally it is claimed by one particular ideology or other. In fact, often a political ideology is trying to make itself invisible by claiming expertise in pop culture political tropes. This has occurred several times during the 19th and 20th century, from literary theory to Russian formalism to the Frankfurt School to postmodern theory. Pop culture is seen as an essential part of both politics and the evolution of politics. I went too far. This should begin to make a case for a renewed libertarian or Austrian approach to the system for measuring and quantifying pop culture, and for adding aesthetics into the study of philosophy, of politics, philosophy, and economics, or PPE. There is an undeniable cultural currency of repeated and recognizable tropes, motifs, cliches, and archetypes. Despite the high budgets of Hollywood productions and marketing, the ease of repeating these high-quality spectacles and distributing them via digital channels continues to become easier on a downward geometric scale. This naturally creates an inflation or a hyperinflation of cliches and stereotypes in digital media, particularly in hyper-commercialized transmedia narratives, for example, cinematic universes, extended canons, and successful media franchises. As audiences become joint producers of this very same recycled content, social media and self-publishing of hyperinflated cliches will continue to expand exponentially. Here, many theories from economics can be applied to pop culture production and distribution. And this is a crux here. Archetypes and cliches can be differentiated by how they act in a cultural marketplace, or how they can be seen in the framework of legal intellectual property. So, archetypes, as literal collective neurological forms, resist ownership and natural property rights. They are non-excludable goods, and therefore are subject to the tragedy of the commons if overused. Clichés and stereotypes can be claimed by individual authors, owned by trademark and copyright laws, and can exist within the legal framework of intellectual property, and therefore are subject to inflation and hyperinflation as currency within that cultural marketplace. For example, the hero is an archetype, but Luke Skywalker, TM, literally trademarked, is a stereotype from the film Star Wars in 1977, and the corporate media canon that followed over sequels and merchandising. It was made into a cliché by several other commercial attempts to copy the popularity of Star Wars in the late 1970s, such as Battle Beyond the Stars, Star Crash, and other mockbusters. So, while the study of intellectual property can inform this discussion, this research is going to focus on the cultural study, although I look forward to asking a bunch of you questions about intellectual property. Not that way. Again, we can turn to economic theory to distinguish why, when, and how archetypes will be concretized by Hollywood-style or state-controlled productions, cycled and recycled as clichés, and hyperinflate based on ownership of cultural capital and intellectual property. At the most centralized and authoritarian context, there exists a cultural landscape of command and control and state ownership. These have existed for brief times in totalitarian and authoritarian states, like those socialist republics. and it usually leads to very banal uses of archetypes into clumsy cliches for the purpose of propaganda. There is copious research into how audiences react to and read against dominant narratives forced upon them by state apparatuses. A contrasting cultural approach is the relatively free market with very limited trademark and IP, leading to folklore, fan fiction, and, with enough technical education and technical advancement, fan films. These systems tend to exist in developing nations where global culture is imported, drastically copied, remixed, and fitted into local conditions. Intellectual property is restricted, and the system can be admittedly utopian, but has existed in developing countries in forms like doujinshi, these are pirated manga, video game modifications, and fan films. This system probably leads to the most efficient allocation of archetype resources into public consumption by allowing for voluntary exchange, gains from trade, specialization and division of labor, and the emergent spontaneous order that was described in Bernard Mandeville's poem. However, the current system in both the US and around the world is much closer to a mixed economy, with state-granted monopolies leading to transnational corporations and the Hollywood studio system. This creates a vibrant economy for some, but will lead to hyperinflation of cliches and stereotypes described earlier. Although legal protection from copyright and trademarks differ, there is considerable overlap that can lead to ambiguity in this mixed economy. Clichés and stereotypes are claimed by individual authors and can lead to this hyperinflation. This oftentimes leads to two things, parody and estrangement. On the idea of irony and parody as landmarks of cultural inflation and archetypes, the anarcho-libertarian Kingsley Widmer points out, quote, "Much indeed of modernism in the arts for more than a century has been parodistic, as with expressionism, futurism, dadaism, surrealism, and indeed the recurrent impetus of avant-garde anti-arts, and still is with postmodernism." Paul Cantor explored parody in both Gilligan Unbound, this is his book, Gilligan Unbound, as in Of the Island, and The Invisible Hand in Popular Culture, but he takes a much more positive tone. He insists that archetypal characters in both The X-Files, which are played completely earnestly, and characters in South Park, which are played as farce, contradict the idea of a post-irony society and openly embrace the fact that they have become parody and that an overextended trademark cliche pop culture that has become. His quote is this, "The cultural elites have passed a death sentence on irony, but it was by no means clear that the American public was willing to carry it out." Along with parody and irony, another important aspect of the interaction of archetypes in popular culture is the process of making recycled old clichés appear to be as novel as the archetypes they represent. The Russian formalist Viktor Shklovsky prefigured Bertolt Brecht's idea, where new art forms in drama work because they have an estrangement of previously familiar ideas. Economically useful storytelling and representation estranges the target audience from the mass media cliches and creates new value by coaxing or requiring individuals to look at that underlying archetype or motif from a new, more personally relevant and socially valuable standpoint. In order to measure the currency of this transaction, we need to have a language that allows us to speak about archetypes and motifs more efficiently as a means of social exchange. Friedrich Hayek could well have been describing archetypes and tropes with his famous quote, "The discovery that there exists orderly structures that are the product of action of many men, but are the result of no design." So what I want to do next to show you some of these, I want to show you some of the already existing means of categorizing archetypes and motifs, from the most open to the least open. The most open, without a doubt, is tvtropes.org. Tvtropes.org begins with a self-referential page, "Your mileage may vary." Despite this, the main narrative tropes page consists of over 15,000 different motifs. The character tropes page lists more than 24,000 motifs. Main plot page cross-referenced them to an astonishing number of deployments. There are slightly over 400,000 different categorized cliches. By contrast, the academic classification systems, typified by the Arne-Thompson-Uther Index, there are other systems like Vladimir Propp's motif interest, Carl Jung's archetypes, etc., lead to some limited gains of trade, but very little actual copywriting. Lastly, a little-known Austrian psychologist named Ernest Dichter pioneered the application of those academic classifications of archetypes into corporate marketing and advertising research. He applied Jungian psychoanalysis to create what the A.C. Nielsen Company puts together for the VAL system and PRISM. These are consumer archetypes that are used to market everything from products to candidates. Each of these systems evolved because of a need for language to describe these phenomena. And a commercial, Tyler Cowen describes this market competition providing an ongoing battleground for opposing high and low cultural forces as the differing goals of the participants build artistic conflict into the system. One of the things that I am doing here is I'm looking to sort of bring two really disparate ideas together. I'm looking for libertarian philosophers like yourselves, and at the same time, people that actually make narratives, films, and bring them together. Something like a combination between Hayek's Montpelier and Society and Andy Warhol's Film Factory. In his influential essay on fairy stories, J.R.R. Tolkien makes this point clear. Fantasy remains a human right. We make our measure, and in our derivative mode, because we are made. Not only made, but made in the image and likeness of a maker. Reinforcing this idea, Virginia Postrel sets out to embrace a spontaneous, evolving popular culture. She says, the future we face at the dawn of the 21st century is, like all futures left to themselves, emergent, complex messiness. Its messiness lies not in disorder, but in an order that is unpredictable, spontaneous, and the ever-shifting pattern created by millions of uncoordinated, independent decisions. Archetypes cut across ethnic groups, across identity groups. This is why they have become an integral part of marketing data and have been increasingly shunned by academics. Don Lavoie and Emily Chamley Wright summed up much of culture and enterprise with the idea that it is certainly true that a free society is not dependent on uncritical acceptance of all values. In fact, we would say that a free society means that many values will be rejected. And they continue, all we have to do is respect each other's rights, and we do not have to respect anyone else's values. In light of this research into the economies of archetypes, it could be said that we have to respect each other's archetypes, but we do not have to respect anyone else's cliché. The trick is, we need a system that allows us to figure out which is which and measure how they are being used. Archetypes and tropes have always been part of commerce. It is time to restore them as both an important cultural phenomenon worth studying and a practical wing of economic thought, so that articulated archetypes, measured motifs, and classified clichés will, in the words of Bernard Mandeville, in their darling folly fickleness, in diet, furniture, and dress, that strange ridiculous vice was made the very wheel that turned the trade. Thank you for your time.